My name is Martha, and I'm a... That's the first time it's ever gotten a laugh. Thank you. Hi. I'm a very, very grateful recovering member in good standing of the Thursday Noon Al-Anon Family Group in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And I first want to thank the committee for inviting me here to share my experience, strength, and hope with you all. And I want to say that there's so much love and so much caring in this room that I'm absolutely overwhelmed by it. I'm so grateful to be here. When I first got off the plane and I met Bob and Ellen, it was like I had just come home from visiting somewhere and they were my family. They've been so kind and good to me. It's just, I can't express my gratitude to them. And before I go any further, I must thank Sharon. Wherever you are in this room, she and I share a secret, and I'm grateful to you. I'll tell you what it was. It won't be a secret anymore. I had to make a quick trip to the ladies' room, and there was a line all the way around the corner. And so I walked up, and I just said, I've never done this before, but please, could I get ahead here? I have to get in there and talk. And Sharon said, step right in. So I'm here by the grace of God and Sharon. Now, they tell us to tell what our life was like and what happened and what it's like now. And I please want you all to know I don't speak for Al-Anon, and my opinions are my own, and I'm certainly not an authority on anything. Now, for me, that's gross to tell you. And I'm not an expert. And my husband defined expert for me. An ex is a has-been, and a spurt is a drip under pressure. Now, I was an expert for about 28 years, but not any longer. I have to begin at the beginning. I'm the youngest of three children, and I was born into a happy, loving home. We were a family that played together, and we prayed together. And I had the most wonderful father in the world. And I remember sitting on his lap and feeling his arms around me, and he'd read stories and the funny papers and things to me. And I could ask him a question, and he always knew the answer. And my two older brothers loved me and protected me and watched out for me. And my mother, my wonderful mother, who would be 90 years old today if she were alive, taught me to have realistic goals for myself. And to be an achiever, be the best you can be. You don't have to be an A student, but be the best you can be. There was no drinking in my home, so I knew nothing about alcohol. And daily, my mother taught us God's way of life. She used simple examples to explain life and death to us. Things like fishnets on the beach, shells on the beach, planting flowers, bulbs that we thought were dead, and then in the spring they came back in all their glorious beauty. She let us see God through the way she lived her life, and my mother's quiet strength and her steadfast faith are a priceless legacy to me, and they've sustained me in sorrow, and they've blessed me in times of joy. And I know that without this faith, I could never have survived the years that were ahead of me. Now, when I was a little girl, I loved to read. And my family saw to it that I had all the right books, but my favorites were the Bible stories for children and the Grimm's fairy tales. And I thought it would be marvelous if someday a handsome prince would come riding up on his horse and sweep me off my feet, throw me on the back of that horse, and we'd ride off into the sunset. That's what I wanted to happen, and y'all better be careful what you pray for. Because one day, this handsome young man rode up on his horse, and he had the shiniest leather boots and spurs, and he was the handsomest hunk I'd ever seen. His dark, wavy hair and his laughing blue eyes, and he had dimples, and he still has that crooked grin that just swept me off my feet. He was everything I ever dreamed of and more. And I decided that someday he was going to marry me, and he did. Well, he was my Prince Charming, but he didn't wear the uniform of, didn't wear the shining armor. He wore the uniform of a United States 6th Cavalryman, and I think that was even better. I knew that he was a hard-riding, tobacco-chewing cavalryman. He told me that when he was riding out on the plains in Fort Riley, Kansas, the dust kicked up and it was hot, and they all had to chew tobacco to keep the dust out of their throats. Now, that was fine. He forgot to tell me that after a hard day of training that they went to the officers' club and sat there and drank straight bourbon. He didn't tell me that, and I never saw him take a drink until after we were married. We were married on the 18th of December in 1942 at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And that was exactly 1 week before Christmas. And on Christmas Eve night was the first time I put my husband to bed drunk, and I didn't know what had happened. All of a sudden, he didn't dance like Fred Astaire anymore. And he was singing in my ear, and it wasn't very pleasant music he was singing. And he was stumbling around, and this was so unlike him. So this was the first time I put him to bed drunk, and I didn't know what happened. And I was very angry because it's the first time I'd ever been close to anybody in my life and felt completely shut out and alone. Because when he had his bottle and his drinks, I was not important to him anymore. And I always wanted to be number one in his life. Well, this happened over and over again, and I thought it was just a one-time thing, but I was sadly mistaken. It happened many, many times. And my handsome hero slowly began slipping off of that horse, and I was right there to catch him and push him right back up again. Because he was my hero, and I was not going to have him any other way. Well, I'm a competitor. I guess maybe you can tell that. And I accepted this challenge to keep him from drinking. I decided that I would think of every way possible. Now, being a good military wife, I had to have plan A and plan B. Now, if you're a good military wife, that's all that you need. But my plans went on down to C, D, E, and F, and all. My first plan was I would reason with him. That's really another word for nagging. And I said, if you loved me, you wouldn't drink. That only justified his drinking and gave him the excuse he was looking for to drink again. And so I tried to bargain with him. And at that time, I was a very heavy cigarette smoker, and I loved to smoke. So I told him, if I can stop smoking, will you stop drinking? And he said, if you want to stop smoking, that's your business. So I thought, it's willpower. That's all it takes. And I'm going to show him how to do this. Well, it was a sacrifice because I didn't smoke for 2 weeks, and I was climbing the walls. And we were living in a large set of quarters at this time, and it had a huge old basement. And I went down to do the laundry one morning, and as I reached over for the soap powder, I looked, and beside the freezer, half hidden, was a bottle of vodka. And I was absolutely furious because it first of all dawned on me why my husband was the first one to volunteer to go to the freezer to get anything out. He always volunteered to change the clothes from the washer to the dryer. And I was furious with him. He thought I was so stupid. I didn't know what he was doing. And I had to get even. So I went upstairs and I got my cigarettes and matches. And I came back down those stairs, and there was a long shelf in the back that had some old flower pots on it. And I stuffed my cigarettes and matches in there. And, you know, that kind of thinking frightens me today. But anyway, it was okay. We made lots of trips up and down those basement stairs. And sometimes we'd even meet each other on the steps. And depending on how many drinks he'd had and how many cigarettes I'd had, sometimes we'd stop and chat. Well, it didn't work, so I was furious, and so I threatened him. I said, I'm going to take these children, and I'm going to leave, and you're never, ever going to see us again. And I waited for him to say, please don't go, and hold me in his arms and say, no, I love you, don't go, I'll stop drinking. Instead of that, he said, honey, you've got two choices, the front door and the back door, and don't let the screen door hit you in the fanny on the way out. Well, I didn't like that. That hurt my feelings. So I tried to cover up for him, because I didn't want anybody to know that he had a problem, because he was my hero. And I wanted him to love me and protect me, and that we would have such a beautiful, happy marriage and wouldn't have any problems. I wasn't very young at that time, as you can tell. Well, we didn't know it, but we were both suffering from the same disease, and it's called alcoholism. He suffered the effects of drinking it, and I suffered the effects of reacting to it. He looked great. He did. But I was a wreck. I was so full of fear and terror, and I didn't know why I was afraid. My hand shook so badly I couldn't light my cigarettes anymore. I was smoking in the open now. And we had a gas stove, and I'd put that cigarette in my mouth and turn on the gas stove and stick my head in there and get the cigarette lit. Now, I didn't have any hair up here or eyebrows, and I had a big blister on the end of my nose that was permanent. Well, I thought I was losing my mind. I really did, because he could convince me that black was white or white was black, whatever. He had me completely buffaloed. And I began having anxiety attacks, but nobody told me that's what it was. I thought I was losing my mind, because for no reason at all, my heart would be in my throat, and it would be pounding, and I was smothering. It was a horrible feeling, and I thought really I was losing my mind. And then I learned many years later that anxiety was the price I paid for playing God. And I also was a victim of agoraphobia, the time in my life when I couldn't go outside. I could not force myself to go outdoors, and I was afraid of the telephone ringing. I was afraid if I went to the door that people would look at me and say, she's crazy. And I didn't know what would happen to my children if they took me away. I wasn't insane, but my behavior was. And I accepted my husband's emotional and verbal abuse, because I thought I had disappointed him. I was not the perfect wife. And I began to play that game of, everything's fine. Oh, yeah, it's fine. That was the outside. But my insides were burning and churning and screaming. Now, I knew somehow that my husband was sick, but it was so baffling and heartbreaking. And I thought he'd stop loving me, and I didn't know why. So I tried to tell his family. I'd covered up all these years, and I thought maybe they'll help me. But I made the mistake of telling that to his mother. She drew herself up, and she said, my son didn't drink till he married you. And I blamed it on her. He was her son, she raised him, and if she'd done it right, he wouldn't have had a problem. Well, and we tried to talk the situation over, but it never worked, because my husband was a good military strategist, and he knew when he was cornered, his best defense was a quick offense. And he attacked me where it hurt the most. He said, well, if you'd keep this house cleaner and if you'd keep those children quiet, I wouldn't have to drink. Well, I tried to comply. I was a good homemaker, I thought. But now it was going to be perfect. And so each day, and I can't believe I did this, but I'm telling you the truth, I'd get up each day, scrub the floors, scrub the woodwork, do the windows, wash and iron clothes, do all of these things. And then I'd look at the floor and I'd say, nope, needs wax. I'd get back on my hands and knees with a razor blade. And I hate razor blades today, because I'd take that razor blade and go around the corners of the room and be sure that every scrap of wax was off. Then I'd get back on my hands and knees and wax them again. Day after day after day. I used my frustration as angry energy. And I cleaned that house like a maniac. But that didn't work either. So I tried to shame him sober. Up to this point, he'd only seen a clean home, quiet children, and when the Lord and Master walked in the door at night, what he smelled was a delicious aroma of freshly baked bread. His wife met him at the door, every hair in place, dressed as best I could, and three precious children seated on the sofa, shining and scrubbed, and even the dog sitting there waiting for Daddy. Well, he's going to see how it got that way. And I had a uniform, too. He had all his gorgeous uniforms and his dress blues and all that mess. My uniform was a little different. I wore the grubbiest, ragged clothes I could find. And it wasn't popular to wear jeans in those days, but I found a pair of men's jeans, and I wore those and some of my husband's old shirts. I didn't comb my hair. I didn't put on any makeup. And my piece de resistance was the torn underwear. And I loved the pair that had nothing but the elastic around the waist and around the legs and then just shredded all around. And I made sure that every night when my husband came home, I was on my hands and knees by the front door with my scrub bucket and brush, and I wanted him to see what his drinking was doing to me. Well, nothing worked, and I felt that I had failed at the one job I wanted to do best in all the world, and that was to be a good wife and a good mother. And I was emotionally crushed because I'd been told I better stop him from drinking, but nobody ever told me how to do that. And my pride kept me silent, because I believe that pride kills more alcoholics today than alcohol does. And today I know that I'm not a sick wife that made my husband an alcoholic. I became emotionally sick when I became a part of the disease. And I was caught between advancing alcoholism and a wall of ignorance because I knew nothing about alcoholism, and a wall of embarrassment. And my reaction was hostility and disillusionment and disappointment. I thought I'd made a mistake. I married the wrong man. Because love can't exist without the dimension of justice. And as long as I paid the consequences for my husband's drinking, what reason did he have to get sober? And it only increased his guilt so that he drank again. And in reality, I'd lost this beautiful, handsome, wonderful man that I married, just as though he were dead. But I couldn't have a funeral because he was still there. But I felt the loss so deeply, and I grieved so much that it hurt terribly. And hurt so much that I tried to shut my feelings off, and then I lost the ability to love. And I felt unwanted and unloved and rejected, and I built that wall high and tight around me so that neither he nor anyone else could get inside. Well, today I know that I can't control how I feel, but I know that I can control what I do about it. And when I'm angry, I recognize it, and I get rid of that guilt quickly, because I've been down the road of guilt, and that nearly destroyed my health. But when you suppress feelings, physical symptoms appear, and for me, they were arthritis, backaches, migraines, and fatigue, because anger takes so much energy. And then there's the depression, and for me, that was the anger that was turned inward that I could not express. And I didn't scream aloud anymore, but I had begun to scream inside, which is even more frightening. And the only way I can describe it is if you've ever had a nightmare where something or someone was chasing you and you were running as fast as you could, but you couldn't get away from it, and you were screaming at the top of your lungs, and nobody could hear you. And that's the way I felt. And I walked the line of sanity and insanity for a long, long time, and it's a thin line. But my husband was a periodic drinker, so they were not all bad times. We had some fun, and we both wanted to make happy memories for our children because we didn't want them to know their father had a drinking problem. And today I become very defensive when I hear anybody say, alcoholics don't have any willpower. If they did, they'd stop drinking. And I know that alcoholics have more willpower than anybody else I've ever met. Today I know how my husband suffered and how he struggled not to take that first drink when he'd promised to go to church with us the next day, because he knew if he took one drink, he couldn't go. And the times that we planned picnics and to take the children to the zoo, I know how he must have struggled to stay away from that drink. I love alcoholics, and I have the greatest love and compassion for those sick and suffering alcoholics who are still out there, and I pray for them every day. Well, it's time for us to retire now. We've been in the military 28 years. We've survived 2 wars, not counting our own private one. My husband said he'd given the best years of his wife to the Army. And he'd been dry for a year. He was going to show himself and everybody else he did not have a drinking problem. And it was a wonderful year. We had so many good times, and we did such wonderful things. It was fun. And then the day that he received his retirement orders, he went back to the kitchen, opened up the bar, and had a drink. And my heart fell. I said, oh, no, no. And he said, get off my back. I've controlled this for a whole year. I'm not an alcoholic. I can do this. Now, just I can handle it. So we had a beautiful retirement party, as they do when you've served time in the Army and it's time for you to retire. It was a beautiful affair. And that night, as we sat in the guest house after the party was over, and my husband was not drunk, he had had some drinks, but he could still control it. And that night we sat there holding hands and thinking back over 28 years of our lives and remembering those 2 young, happy people who were married at Fort Jackson so many years ago, and wondered what had happened to all the hopes and dreams we had. But we had other hope. Tomorrow was a new day. We were going to start a new life together. My husband said he didn't want alcohol to have any part of it. And so he got up and he took his bottle and he went over to the sink and poured it out. And the next morning, we went to the regimental chapel to church. It was Easter Sunday, a beautiful day to start a new life. And our friends were there to wave us off. And just as we were ready to leave, one friend came up and gave us a calling card and said, when you get to Virginia Beach, look this couple up. They were in the service with us, and give them our love, and then you'll have somebody there that you know. So I took it and put it in my pocketbook, and off we went. And as we drove that day, we were at Fort Knox on our way back to Richmond, Virginia, to spend the night with my mother before we went to Virginia Beach. And as we got to the motel that night, my husband took his suitcase out, and I knew the signs. He'd been irritable and grouchy and tired, his back hurt and his headache. He got in the into the room, threw the suitcase on the bed, and one whole side was lined with bottles of bourbon. And my heart sank, and I thought, you lied to me again. But I didn't realize then that at the time, he told me the truth, but he couldn't help himself, and I didn't know he was sick. So we didn't have anything to say to each other. We'd said it all. And I did the driving from then on, because he wasn't capable of it. And we got to Virginia, and when we got there, he went into my mother's kitchen and took his bottle out and slammed it up on the kitchen sink. And she looked at me and didn't say anything, but the look in her eyes just crushed me. I could see pain. And the next morning when we left, my mother handed me a little book, and she said, take this with you, honey. You might have time to read it after you get to the beach. So we got down to the beach, and we took an apartment on the ocean side. And this began 3 weeks in our lives. It was to be a turning point, because for 28 years I'd walked the road to hell with my husband, and now we're at a crossroads. And at the end of those 3 weeks, for 2 days, I'd not slept, and he had only passed out to wake up to pass out. And I couldn't sleep for fear he'd drop a cigarette and burn himself up. And this was a point in my life that I never thought I'd ever reach. Because I'd been taught and had been given the greatest gift that parents can give their child, and that's faith in a forgiving and loving God who would watch over me always and be with me always. But at this point, I was at the very end of the road. See, the children were grown now, and they didn't need me anymore. And my husband didn't need me, didn't want me, didn't love me, I thought. And so for the first time in my life, I didn't want to live. And I thought, I can walk out on the beach, and I can swim, and keep going, and it'd be so easy. But you know, wonderful things happen when you least expect it. I happened to look over that chair by the door, and there was the book that my mother had given me, and I tossed it there. And I picked it up, and I thought, you know, I can kill myself tomorrow. I better read this book. And as I sat there and opened up that book, the words in red leaped out at me, and they said, "Lo, I am with you always." And in that instant, all of the teachings of my childhood came flooding back to me. And I knew I was not alone. I knew God loved me. And I slid to my knees, and I prayed what is, I think, the most powerful prayer anyone can pray. God, help me. I can't help myself. I can't help my husband. I don't know what else to do. I've tried it all. And in that quiet dawn, suddenly, a strange thing happened to me. There was a warm feeling that enveloped me, just like someone put his arms around me. A strange, warm feeling deep inside of me that filled up all the emptiness that had been there, driving out all the doubt and the fear and the loneliness. And it reminded me of a hymn my mother used to sing when I was a child. Before me lay a sea of doubt, so great I feared to pray. But the mighty Lord stretched out his hand, and he rolled the sea away. And I'd let go and let God, and I didn't know that, and a miracle happened. That miracle of that moment belongs to my husband, because all I did was give him back his life and his problems. They were never mine to begin with. And a few hours later, another miracle happened. My husband called AA for help. Now, the two people that AA sent out to call on us talked to us, they related to us, they told us things that I thought they'd peeped in my windows. How could they know these things? And he was a military man, she was a military wife, and I believe firmly that God puts the people in your life at the time you need them most and for the right purpose. And I think you already have guessed. Those two people are the ones that we were supposed to have looked up when we got to Virginia Beach and didn't do it because we couldn't. That's no coincidence, you know that. You know, Longfellow said that the lowest ebb is the turn of the tide, and I think that's appropriate in my story because I was at my lowest ebb right there beside the ocean. And then came the turn of the tide. Victory came to both of us in surrender. Now, we went to an open AA meeting a couple days later, and it was the most thrilling place I'd ever been. I fell madly in love with those alcoholics, hugged them and kissed them. They loved me back, and that's so important, and I hope it will continue forever and ever. Because when a person like me comes into a program so afraid at the end of everything and then sees hope for the alcoholic and desperately wants to know there's hope for her or him, and all of those AA people took me in their arms and they told me everything was going to be all right, to leave my husband to them. And I did. And they let me come to those open meetings for a whole week. It was so much fun. And when they would speak and I'd listen to them and they'd tell the same things my husband had done when I thought he was crazy, and yet they'd done the same thing, and I thought, hey, he's not crazy at all. This is wonderful. And we all laughed and laughed. The end of the week, it was Monday then, and we went to the church, met the friends at the church, and we got to the door, and they started to follow Jack down to the room, and he said, wait a minute, Martha, you can't go here. And I said, why? He said, this is a closed AA meeting. And I said, well, that's where I want to go, because I thought that's where they told the secret of how to keep him from drinking. Well, it wasn't that at all. And they said, no, there's a place for you, and it's called Al-Anon, and it's time for you to get there. Well, I was not pleased with this. And one took me by one arm and the other by the other arm, and they marched me across the hall, opened the door, threw me in, said, here's another one for you. I love those two AA men today. I go to their birthdays, and it's just wonderful. They're my best friends. Because I wasn't in that room 2 minutes before I knew I'd come home. I found what I'd searched for and didn't know I was looking for. These beautiful people understood me. They loved me when I was unlovable. I was physically exhausted, emotionally sick. And they told me I was forgiven long before I could forgive myself. And they shared their experience, their strength, and their hope with me and became a part of me, making me a whole person again. Al-Anon friends understand your past, they believe in your future, and they accept you just the way you are today. Alcoholism is a family disease, but all of us who suffer through the drinking years and the devastation that it brings to our lives can know the boundless joy of recovery in Al-Anon, Al-Ateen. And we got sick together, and so now we can get well together. And they told me alcoholism is a disease, not a disgrace, and I didn't cause it. I couldn't control it, and I was the last person to cure it. And they told me this. I didn't fail as a wife and a mother. I did the best I could. And they told me that we're not bad people trying to get good. We're sick people trying to get well. And I don't believe there are any good or bad people today. Just those of us who are getting better and those who are getting worse. And recovery, thank goodness, is a process. It's not an event. It doesn't happen like that. And they gave me back my self-confidence, my self-respect, and my courage, and the opportunity to express my feelings without the guilt of betrayal, because it wasn't a secret anymore. And I could talk my problems over with those who understand and don't condemn. And they taught me to release with love and faith. And when I did that, it released my alcoholic to get well. And to release with love is the object. And it's not a tool to use as a weapon, but it is a tool for serenity. But to remain a slave to alcoholism is to be destroyed and to severely injure the little children, and it contributes to the illness of the alcoholic. And Al-Anon is free. If your life has been affected by someone else's drinking, you've paid your dues. Al-Anon said, I got to tell you this real quick because time's getting away from us. My birthday was 3 weeks after my husband found AA. It took him a while to get sober, but in the AA. And he wanted it to be a nice birthday. He said, honey, you've had so many sad ones. And he said, I want it to be the best one you've ever had. So he's such a thoughtful man. He had a huge orchid corsage for me. He took me out to dinner, and we danced again like we did when we were young. Jitterbug, you know. There was such fun. It was a beautiful evening. And the evening was over, and he said, well, it's time to go home. And so we got in the car and started back, and he said, we're really going to have some fun tonight. And I said, oh, that sounds exciting. So we got back home, and he stopped the car, and he opened the trunk, and here in the back of the trunk were 8 quarts of bourbon and some vodka. And I thought, I don't believe this. I can't go through this again. He said, you pick up some of those bottles, and I'll take the rest, and we'll take them in the kitchen. So I followed along behind him, and we went to the kitchen sink. And he said, okay, you pour out yours, and I'll pour out mine. Now, he tells that story when he shares his story, and one night when I was with him, there was a poor fella who had just attended his first meeting sitting right there on his hands, shaking from head to toe, and he heard that, and he looked up with his stricken face, and he said, oh, Lord, mister, I come here to get some serenity, not to get my heart broke. See, at that point in his recovery, he was not able to give those bottles to somebody because he was so afraid there would be one drink in there that would push one person over the line into alcoholism, and he couldn't handle it. Today, he would probably give them to friends, but he couldn't do it then. And the other thing I need to tell you is when he stopped drinking, I was able to stop smoking with the aid of the 12 steps, and I am grateful for that. And one other thing, you remember that torn underwear? Well, I wanted to hurt him, and I did hurt him. And when he'd say to me, honey, don't you have anything better to wear than that? And I'd snarl at him, and I'd say, no, I don't. You spend all them extra money on your booze, and the children need clothes. There's no money left over for me, and besides, nobody sees the underwear but you. Well, today, he buys all of my lingerie. And everything matches, and it's all different colors and lace and chiffon. And he showed me he's got a gold card at Frederick's of Hollywood. You didn't know that, did you? Al-Anon gave me the tools, and they said, here, Martha, make your program. You have a choice. You no longer have to be unhappy. You no longer have to feel rejected and unloved. This is for you. Make yourself a program. And each day I make that choice. Each day when I open my eyes, the first thing I do is thank God for giving me another beautiful day. And I ask him to help me not to mess it up. And right away, I have to take the first 3 steps, because they're surrender steps. Y'all know that. And I have to surrender every single day, and sometimes during the day, too, but I start that way. Admit my powerlessness over alcohol, and that my life is unmanageable, and that I have come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. I make that big decision to turn my life and will over to him. And I ask for his will, but I always ask for the strength and power to carry it out. And then I imagine the great hands of God, and I mentally place each one of my loved ones in the hollow of God's hands, and I pray that he will watch over them and take care of them. And Al-Anon said, get off your husband's back. Take your hands off his life. Turn the problems over to God and begin to do something about your life. You are special. I didn't know that. So I got off his back, and the chains that bound me fell away. And at last, I was free. They taught me to take my inventory, and I didn't care for that because I lost my halo the first time. Shocked to see myself because I'd changed from a happy, caring person into a self-pitying, grouchy old irritable grouch. That's what I was. Because I saw what alcohol did to him, but I never saw what it was doing to me. But I finally come to accept myself as I am. I'm imperfect, and it's okay. And I'm inadequate, and that's okay too. And I'm neither good nor bad. I'm just blessed to have been loved enough in Al-Anon to love myself again. And that has set me free to love unconditionally. Now, I thought my children were not affected by alcoholism because I'd covered up so well. Wrong. They were as much affected by their mother's neurotic behavior as by their father's drinking. I never physically abused them, but verbal and emotional abuse, I believe, are just as bad and maybe worse. And I was frustrated and tired, and I took out my anger on them, not their father, because he could get drunk. And today I can still see those little faces with the puzzled looks. See my son put his arm around me and say, "Are you okay, Mom?" And I'd scream at him, "I'm fine, if you just keep your dirty feet off of this clean floor." And the middle child would look up at me, and I had deep frowns, and she'd look up here and rub my face, and she'd say, "Mama, let's laugh." She was so full of bubbly personality, and she wanted to laugh all the time, and she didn't know why Mama wasn't laughing. And then the youngest, her daddy's heartstrings, and she's sitting right there. And she'd look at me, and she'd say, "Why are you so mean to my daddy?" See, the children thought that my anger was their fault, and they felt guilty because they didn't know what they'd done. One minute, Mother was laughing and playing, and it was fun. Next minute, I was screaming and yelling at them, and they didn't know what they'd done. They were so anxious to please, though, and so quick to forgive, and with tight hugs around the neck, and they never knew what caused their mother's screaming rages. They sensed Daddy was sick, and each night, the last thing I did was to stand by their beds and see that they were covered up and that they were safe. And they looked so innocent and so helpless. And I'd stand there and pray for patience. "Please, God, don't let me scream at them tomorrow. Please help me to be a good mother." And all I had to hear the next day was the gurgle of a drink being sneaked in the closet. And I was emotionally drunk before my husband had ever taken a swallow. Well, I can't make amends for the lost years. The children have grown. They have their own families. But we did something right because it all turned out well. And God compensates. He gave us 6 gorgeous grandchildren, 6 boys and 6 girls. And today, with God's help, I'm filled with strength. What did I say? Oh, see, I'm not nervous. 3 boys and 3 girls. That's right. 6 grandchildren. Is that right? Okay, so I'm filled with strength and energy to be what I am and to do what I have to do and what I want to do. And I'm grateful for that because today I can make amends to my children in sobriety, and it's wonderful. 3 years ago, my husband gave me a horse. We used to ride together before we were married. And he gave me a horse, something I'd wanted all my life. And today I can't tell you the joy and the thrill and the excitement it is to ride in a fox hunt on those old plantations in Virginia with my middle daughter and my granddaughter. And I can keep up with them, too. And I want to tell you quickly about Christmas in Oregon. Last Christmas, my daughter, Candy, said, "We're going skiing, Mom. I know you haven't skied since we left Germany, but you can do it, I'm sure. And I'm game. I'm a competitor." So we went up to Bend, Oregon, and it was the most thrilling thing I've done in many, many years. And when my daughter and I went up on that ski lift together, as we climbed thousands and thousands of feet up that mountainside, and I looked up, and the sky was a brilliant blue, and the snow all around, the trees, it was a perfect sight. It was beautiful. And I sat there beside her and remembered this was the little one who looked at me with such puzzlement and said, "Why are you so mean to my daddy?" And we have such a good relationship today. She's my best friend. And as we held hands going up there, and I had this thought, this is another spiritual experience. And we could almost reach out and touch the face of God. It was so beautiful. And as we started down the hill, I fell down a few times, and finally my daughter said, Mama, why don't you get in the same position you get in when you jump your horse? So I got in that position, and we started down the hill, and I mean to tell you, I didn't fall anymore. And it was so much fun, and all of a sudden I heard something whizzing by me around here, and here was my granddaughter and my grandson waving their sticks and saying, "Go for it, Grandma!" And another great blessing of this program has come to us recently. We didn't know about it. There's no alcoholism in my daughter's home, but she grew up in an alcoholic home. And while everything was going fine, everything was doing well in their home, the older she got, the more she realized something was wrong. And I'm grateful that we took her to so many open AA meetings and to so many Al-Anon meetings because she said, I know something's wrong with me. And then she told us just a few months ago she's been in Al-Anon for 9 months. And I am so grateful for that, the fact that she knew something was wrong and knew where to go to help herself. And it's easy to work this program when everything is going well. You know that. It's really easy. But when your world suddenly falls apart, you know what a blessing this God-given program is. And I never fully appreciated this program until that beautiful spring morning when I answered a knock at the door. And two Marines were standing there with a chaplain. And they'd come to tell me that my only son, a Marine fighter pilot, had been shot down on a bombing mission over Vietnam. He was on his second tour of duty, and I never worried about him because I put him in God's hands, you know. And he came back the first time, highly decorated, and I didn't have any fear for him. I knew he was doing what he wanted to do and what he believed in doing. And I really couldn't believe what they were telling me. And I heard one word. They said missing, not dead. So I held on to that, and there was the hope that the search and rescue teams would find him and pick him up. Well, I don't know how our friends knew, but in a short time, our home was filled with that circle of love, which is AA and Al-Anon. And my husband and I couldn't sleep. There was no way. Our friends left when it was late at night, and so we walked the floor, and finally we just held each other. We laid down and held each other, clinging with a heartache that was so enormous that no human power could remove it. We knew that our higher power could and would if he were sought. And my husband's prayer was, I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I thank God for my sobriety. And I thank God I don't have to leave you tonight to face this alone and go out and get drunk. It's the first crisis we ever faced together in our married life. The best excuse he ever had for a drink. But he stayed sober. There's a great power in this God-given program. God didn't let this happen to us until before sobriety because he knew we couldn't handle it. But during the agonizing years, it's been over 15 years, and we don't know whether our son's alive or not. But the faith that was given to me as a child sustains me. Because when tragedy comes, we can choose how it affects us. We can say, why did God let it happen? Or we can say, how is God going to use this? Because I believe with all of my heart that God allows things to happen for a reason and that good comes from everything. And each experience that I've had makes for spiritual growth. And if I can accept with faith that all things work together for good, I'm all right because my God has never made a mistake. And I no longer think of my son as missing because God knows where he is. And I no longer question, is he alive? Because I believe he is alive somewhere, somehow. And my mother comforted me with this story of another mother whose son was missing and she didn't know where he was. And she kept praying to God just as I was. Where is my son? Do you have him? Is he with you? I can't rest until I know, is he alive or is he dead? And finally, God answered her prayer, and he said, I have your son. He's safe with me. But more important for you to remember is, I gave you my son to comfort you. God has given me the strength to accept what he is, because he won't allow me to endure anything that he and I can't handle together. And my God walks with me on my mountaintops, and I've had many. And he carries me through the valleys because I can't do it alone. Sometimes people say to me, things like this only happen to people who are strong. I don't believe that. I believe that you get strong through faith and prayer. And as you can see, my gratitude spills over. But before you can dry another person's tears, you too must cry. And today, by the grace of God, I see rainbows through my tears. And today I thank God that because my husband is a recovering alcoholic, I've found Al-Anon and a beautiful new life. And I'm grateful for my troubles because they've taught me courage. And I'm grateful for my afflictions because they've taught me compassion. And I'm grateful for my disappointments because they're teaching me humility. And most of all, I'm grateful for my weaknesses. Because of them, I feel the need of God. And I'm grateful to AA for sharing its program with us, as you all so graciously and generously shared your disease with us. And I'm grateful to you, too, for teaching me I'm not responsible for my husband's disease or for his sobriety. And today I can say to this man I love you and I need you, but I cannot handle your responsibilities. And no matter how much I want to help, I can't do it for you. And I'm able to release him with love. He's free to work out his life as it's best for him, and it's a decision only he can make. Al-Anon taught me that I carry a message, not the person. Now, in the beginning, I was so thrilled with this wonderful message of Al-Anon, I carried it everywhere, whether people wanted it or not. And I tried to force it on them because I had looked for it for so long, I couldn't understand why they didn't want it, and I was right there to give it to them. But my mother showed me a cocoon one day and told me a story about a man who was walking through the woods, and there was a big fat cocoon on a tree branch and was swinging back and forth, and he could see something in there struggling, trying to get out. And I think he must have been an Al-Anon because he wanted to fix it. He took out his pocket knife and he slit open the cocoon, thinking that the butterfly would fly away and he would be so proud of himself if he could do that. Instead of that, the butterfly was not able to fly. It fell to the ground. And the reason is that the butterfly in that dark, tight cocoon, before it became a butterfly, had to struggle and fight and believe in a power greater than himself, that somehow it was going to be all right, and he was doing his part. And it's in pain and suffering and in the struggle that his wings were strengthened enough that he could force his way out of the cocoon and then fly. And it's the same with us. When we're in our dark times and we feel smothered and in a tight cocoon and there's no way out, keep faith in a God who loves you. Because when you struggle and when you try and you supply the willingness, God will supply the power. And this is how we get our spiritual muscles. And remember, just when the caterpillar thinks its life is over, God changes it into a butterfly. And it flies away, happy, joyous, and free. And there are no shortcuts. Pain is necessary. Only misery is optional. Alcoholism is baffling, powerful, cunning, and it's patient. It's always there, but we don't worry about that anymore because worry is an insult to God. And if we pray, why worry? And if we worry, why pray? And worry is when I put worst things first. And time is such a great healer. We don't relive the past because we can't change that. And we've forgiven each other for the past because we've learned to forgive ourselves. And forgiveness is just another word for love. Mark Twain said it so beautifully when he said, "Forgiveness is the fragrance that a violet sheds on the heel that crushed it." Forgiveness is to be able to remember without resentment. And so we go forward together a day at a time, and each night we thank God for another beautiful day. And miracles continue to happen. 2 years ago, Thanksgiving morning, my husband collapsed in my arms with a massive heart attack. And I thought when I looked at him that he was dead, and my first thoughts were, "No, it's too soon, it's too soon." And I called the rescue squad, and I sat on the floor and held him in my arms, and I thought, if I hold him tight, he can't slip away. And I kept talking to him and telling him I was there, and I wouldn't leave. And then I remembered, didn't I put my husband in God's hands this morning? I had released him to God's care and God's love, and once again, that warm feeling of peace and serenity surrounded me. I knew we weren't alone, and so I prayed for God to help my husband and to help me, and that I knew whatever happened would be all right. And a miraculous thing did happen. My husband recovered. He had a massive heart attack with minimal damage, and today he's strong and healthy and well. And I thank God that today we walk in faith and not in fear, because God has done for us what we could not do for ourselves. And in closing, I want to sum up what Al-Anon has done for me with a story from my childhood about an oyster shell on the beach. And when I saw that oyster shell, I thought it was the ugliest thing I'd ever seen. And my mother said, not really. Turned it over, and inside was a beautiful pearly look. And I said, well, it is pretty. And she said, well, this is the story of an oyster. They live out there in oyster beds doing whatever oysters do that makes them happy. And they just sit there not bothering anybody. And one day, a sharp grain of sand gets into that soft flesh of the oyster. And he said, the oyster doesn't sit there and say, why me? And it doesn't sit there with a martyr face and just look so pathetic and say, maybe I'll just endure this and it'll go away. That oyster must know that there's a loving God. Because right away, it starts to do its part. And slowly and carefully, it builds a milky substance wrapped around this piece of grain of sand that's bothering it and hurting it. And finally, out of all that pain and misery, something exquisite is born, and that's a beautiful pearl. Now, Al-Anon has done this for me. Alcoholism is the painful, hurtful thing that came into an otherwise beautiful and happy marriage. But Al-Anon has taught me how to cover the fear with faith, and the anger with serenity, and the guilt with acceptance, and all the despair with hope. And the resentment with compassion, and self-pity with gratitude, and to cover the false pride with the beginning of humility, and to cover all that insanity with sanity, and to cover the terrible hate with love. Because love is what Al-Anon is all about. Love of each other, love of the alcoholic, love of ourselves, and of our God. The message of Al-Anon is hope. And we can begin with just a spark of hope and a little glimmer of faith. And through honest study and practice of Al-Anon thinking, we can fan that spark and glimmer into a blaze of hope and faith that lights our lives and the lives of all of those around us. And I thank God for every Al-Anon and AA friend who loved me and understood me and guided me every step of the way. No longer do I have to live in guilt and remorse for the yesterdays. I was frozen, and you thawed me out and gave me back the ability to love, and you told me to give it away, and it comes back tenfold. And this is what I've tried to do today, and I want you to remember something. Don't ever forget it. If your miracle hasn't happened yet, right now, this very moment, your miracle is in the making. God bless all of you. I love you so much, and thank you for having me here.